Welcome to Global Minnesota Podcasts, connecting, informing, and engaging Minnesotans with the world and exploring important international issues. For a complete list of programs and to join us, visit globalminnesota.org.
Thank you. Thank you very much for the nice invitation. Yes, we thought it might be helpful to get some background information. Not everybody will be familiar with it. So where is Rwanda? In East Central East Africa, surrounded by the bigger countries of Uganda, Tanzania, and Congo, and the even small country Burundi in the south. This small country, which is like Maryland, but has today 13 million inhabitants, the most densely populated country of Africa, is called the beautiful country of the thousand hills, or Switzerland of Africa, with its national park. Some of you have heard or may have been there in the mountain gorilla park in the north. But this wonderful country saw one of the most terrible genocides of history. The 20th century was the century of mass killings and genocide in the special technical sense. There were three mega genocides with more than 1 million victims, you all know, of the Armenians 1915, Jews and others 1940s in Germany and Europe. And the third mega genocide was that of the Tutsi, against the Tutsi, in 1994 in Rwanda. The genocide in Rwanda distinguishes among these terrible mass killings as the quickest genocide of history, the most effective, if you want to say so. 1 million killed in 100 days. This is per day three times more than people were killed in 9/11 in New York. It was the most public genocide in that sense that it did not take place in concentration camps, but in every village and town from morning till evening before the eyes of the world population, which did nothing. And it was also the most popular genocide with the highest percentage of the normal population being active in the killings. And it was, of course, very cruel. It was a grace to be shot. People had paid money for that. In pre-colonial times, these different population groups shared the same kingdom, language, and culture. Hutu and Tutsi and Twa were not tribes in a strict sense, but were more socioeconomic classes. You had a certain wealth and you were considered a Tutsi, but it was possible to become a Tutsi when you had been a Hutu. But the colonial powers misunderstood it and re-ethnicized it, so the division of society was created by them. The Germans were there only very short, until 1916, but mainly the Belgian colonial power and the dominating Catholic Church made the division, but later also the Rwandans themselves. We cannot only blame the colonial powers. In the 1930s, it was written in the passport if you were Hutu, Tutsi, or Twa, and this should become the death sentence for hundreds of thousands later. First, a Tutsi elite was favored, but later in the 50s, the policy of the colonial powers changed, and then there was in 1959 a bloody revolution, and the Hutu took over power, and it was said that only the majority should take over the important positions in society. There was a dangerous, bogus democracy, all power to the ethnic majority, a quota system in schools and everywhere, discrimination of all Tutsi already in the 60s. So this genocidal policy or mentality did not come overnight, but it started already in the 60s and 70s and was there over decades. There were big massacres. The parents of Denise had to flee to neighbor countries, and there was always impunity for these mass killings in the 60s and 70s. Hundreds of thousands had to flee to neighbor countries, and their return was prevented over three decades. All parts of society were involved. The churches defended the quota system. All professions, also social teachers and nurses, everybody was participating in the killings, men as well as women. There is a famous book, Not So Innocent, about the active role of women too. Few resisted at this time, like Bishop Bigirumvi or Christians of the so-called East African Revival Movement. They said, we are all Christian, we belong together. But some of them had to die, like this pastor Yona, as a martyr. There was an escalation in the 90s when the Tutsi, who were prevented over 3 decades to return, entered by force in October 1990 by the army which invaded under the now President Kagame. And the consequence was that all Tutsi were declared as accomplices, though most of them were completely apolitical, like the husband of Denise. 1 million machetes were imported, radical Hutu militias were trained, and there were already in the 90s plans for a final solution of the Tutsi question. These new massacres were a test how the international community would react. It did not react, and this was encouragement for the final solution. And as always, before genocides, there was a murderous propaganda. The radio RTLM dehumanized Tutsi as cockroaches, snakes, spiders, and if you dehumanize human beings like that, it's the easier to kill them in the most cruel way. There were already in one newspaper the so-called Ten Commandments of the Hutu, which said, we shall consider a traitor any Mhutu who marries a Tutsi woman, befriends a Tutsi woman, and so on. All strategic positions must be given to Hutu only. And the most terrible of these commandments, the Hutu should stop having mercy of the Batutsi. This should become true very soon. On April 6th of 94, hell on earth broke out in Rwanda. There was the plane shot in which the President Habyarimana and other officials were sitting, and this was a pretext for the long-planned final solution. Of course, the Tutsi rebels were blamed for this shooting down, but now we have a lot of international investigations which have shown that the own Hutu military forces had shot this plane in order to prevent any power sharing. But more important is the systematic massacres were planned before. And it was the greatest failure of the world community and the United Nations after the Second World War. There were United Nations soldiers, the UNAMIR troops, but they were forbidden to intervene. They could only watch. And finally, they were drawn away. General Dallaire was forbidden to intervene. He knew about what was happening before. He cabled it to New York, but they interdicted him to do anything. So after that, today we have this responsibility to protect as a policy of the world. We hope it will be done. There is an impressive example in this BBC documentation, which was the basis for the movie Shooting Dogs, which shows how the UNAMI soldiers shall protect 2,000 school children, and then they are withdrawn, and this priest stays with them. He stays for the few who resisted and wanted to die with them. And this movie I can recommend very much. It's much better than Hotel Rwanda, because the hotel manager of this movie was not a real hero, and now he leads a rebel group which wants to overthrow the Rwandan government by force. In these 100 days, there were 10,000 of stories like Job, people who suffered again and again. Only 2 examples. After their husbands were burned alive, these women had to bring their baby boys that their heads were cut off in front of them. Others were forced to kill their own children. These are the women we are caring for now in our region. Much can be explained historically, psychologically, but there remains arrest. The mystery of such incredible cruelties, the absolute evil became visible. And one professor of psychology in Germany said, the view into this hell has shattered the conviction that our world is principally good. And still there were a few heroes of civil courage who stayed with the Tutsi and sometimes died with them. And Denise will tell you a little bit more in the interview session. Thank you very much.
Now we'd like to invite out Denise Wimana and Ellen Kennedy for a conversation right now.
Good evening, everyone. We are both just delighted to be here with you. I want to begin tonight by saying that this is a remarkable woman with a remarkable story. Every genocide has those tragic stories of people who were the victims. Every genocide has those tragic stories of those people who survive, but who find it very difficult to move forward with their lives. But there are also people who are like Denise, who not only survive, but thrive. Denise is indeed someone who thrives. The book that she has written about her experience, that's available out in the foyer after our program, is a heart-wrenching story of violence, of trauma, but also of healing. And that's going to be part of our focus this evening. How does someone move from survival to being able to thrive? Let's begin, Denise, with some of the happy memories that you have of your childhood and later of your family life with your beloved late husband, Charles, and your sons.
I have a very good childhood. Although I grew up as a refugee child because my parents fled from Rwanda in the 60 years, from Rwanda to Burundi. Later they moved again, they flee again from Burundi to Congo. But in my family, I had lovely parents, they used always to gather us the evening time to sing, to pray, and also I joined Sunday school, normal Sunday school, as the other children. I was in Burundi. Burundi, there I was born there. Even our neighbors were very kind. We had, for example, a man who used to play with us with oranges. This good memory I have. I remember that even sometimes I had him when I was going to around a ship. Yeah, a ship. Ran against me, and then he kicked me with his coat. This is a memory I remember. I grew up in family where 9 children, and they were all in Congo or in Burundi, and they were alive. My husband, I had a good husband. Unfortunately, it was just for a short time. I could not really enjoy. We had many dreams, good dreams, how we care for our children. We used to travel the weekends, Burundi, Congo, Bukavu. People who know Rwanda or Burundi, Congo can understand. It's because he worked in a cement company as an engineer, geologist. Engineer, and he spent his time in also in Congo because he fled the country and he came back to Rwanda. But this short time was really good, unfortunately short.
Tell us a little bit about the children that you and Charles were able to enjoy together.
I have 3 boys, 2 children. Were born before the genocide. One was born during the genocide in a dramatic situation we read in my book. The firstborn, now he is 29 years old. The second is 26. The third one, who was born during genocide, is 25. Mm.
You grew up in Burundi, and Burundi has also had many troubles between the Hutus and the Tutsis. Mm-hmm. You spent time in Congo, where there also has been conflict. Mm-hmm. What is your earliest memory or recollection of learning about Tutsis and Hutus as being in some way separated from one another, of being divided?
The first memory I remember is that when we start to grow up, my papa used to tell us how he fled. Mama and papa fled from Rwanda to Burundi. And I heard that some of us here know the hospital called Kibogora is a hospital which is known in Rwanda. Their papa worked, and then he was a nurse. And then there his colleague told him that he was seeking to be killed. Then he fled. Then papa used to tell us all the memories how in Rwanda there were hate between Hutu and Tutsi. He used to tell us all the stage he passed through. But when I was 20 years old, I came to visit my own grandparents where they lived in Kibuye. Then I went again to the southwest where my aunt was married. Then there was a man, a leader from the place. He was at that time called it was someone who was a leader of a district. He has a big hate. He saw me on the way when I was walking. He stopped me. He said, "You must be someone who do not like someone from here." And he took me like one who is making spire. Spitting. And then he took me to at that time it was like a commune at that time, to the burgomaster, and he asked him to put me into prison. It's short story. They took me to the border, and when I arrived at the border of Rwanda and Congo, I met the officer from the border. He shouted with bad words against me. Why did you come to Rwanda? I said, "I was coming to visit my relatives and to seek job." "You will never know Tutsi can get a job." And he shouted behind me, he threw me, and I went back to Congo. This has been also a very traumatic situation because it was the beginning to hate Rwanda. I was 20, because even when I heard the radio speaking, I turned off.
The genocide in Rwanda happened for many complicated reasons, but it also happened because of what you are speaking about and because of what Wolfgang was mentioning, and that is that people were easily incited to act against their friends, their neighbors, sometimes even against their own loved ones. And we know that incitement like this happens in every genocide. Why do you think people in Rwanda were listening to the hate speech on the radio and reading the Ten Commandments that were so poisonous about the Tutsis and believing those hateful words to kill the Tutsis?
Yeah, my husband, of course, spoke about the background. When I remember in Rwanda how it happened, it's because there always propaganda. They always did not even welcome the Tutsi as Rwandans at that time. They always speak that they are people who came from Ethiopia. They did not say that they are Rwandans. And they always call them cockroaches. They say they are snakes. It's everything started by ideology, propaganda against the Tutsi. That's why it was easy. They humanized us. That's why it was even easy. In the family, it was taught that this Hutu or this Tutsi are our enemies. At school, they always, children were always, children of Tutsi were always discriminated by Hutu. So churches everywhere, they were spoken about Tutsi. Tutsi all didn't, they were neglected, yeah, in the society, yeah.
It started very young. And in Rwanda in particular, there were young people, many of whom were young men, who were particularly vulnerable to this hate. And they became part of the militia known as the Interahamwe.
Yes.
Would you speak a little bit about the Interahamwe?
Interahamwe, there were young people, or young, normal young people, who were trained in different places in Rwanda. I saw when I was at Simerwa how they used the stadium, short, there was a stadium. They used every morning, they came, they were running, walking to go to like how soldiers are training. They trained them to kill, they prepared them to kill, and they were promised them, oh, we will give you job at Simerwa. I'm speaking about my area where. We will give you job at Simerwa, and even when we will kill Tutsi, you will get their properties. So they were promising many things. That's why they were also trained. And even they say Tutsi had no value.
You were aware, you knew that this was happening around you, of course. Mm-hmm. What were the feelings that you had about this?
Oh, the feeling I had, if I remember, no, myself, as because my husband, as my husband, I speak yes from my husband, Wolfgang, has said about the background. When the war started, in October 1990, my husband was put into prison. And no one was allowed to come to see me at home. Even the one who tried to come to see me at home, he was put into prison. This is the truth. So at that time, the feeling I have, I was hopeless first. I couldn't even understand why, because myself, I came from Rwanda, from Congo, to come to Rwanda to marry, and I had identity of Zairois, of Congolese, in my own country, because I grew up, when I came, I was even not welcomed in society. I even remember that people used to look at me and say, you are not even a really Rwandan at work. I remember even my colleagues, once he took my chair, took out.
Oh my.
Yeah, he said you are not allowed to sit because our work, the leader were Chinese. I went to my Chinese chef to tell him the situation, and he came back, he came to my office, he gave me again my chair. So I was dehumanized, I was sad, I did not feel that I am at home in the society, not only myself, all Tutsi were living in fear.
But yet you and your husband had very good jobs at the cement factory.
Mm-hmm.
You had wonderful children you were raising together. You had a beautiful home. You had dreams. You had dreams and hopes.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what makes it so hard to understand the reality of the genocide when it occurs. And what happened in Rwanda was that there were lists that were drawn up of Tutsis and where they were, and the Hutus were told to go and exterminate them.
Mm.
Can you tell us a little bit about how that happened? How did people know where the Tutsis were? Which families were Tutsis? Which homes? Where to find them?
Of course, everyone know everyone.
Small country, very yeah. small country.
Because also the divisionism started when the identity was brought in our country. As my husband Wolfgang said, we were one culture, one people, and European came and understand about our culture. But in my time, when I get to know Rwanda, I come to live in Rwanda, it was terrible because everyone was identified by their identity. Hutu, Twa, Tutsi. I was always thinking, these people are Hutu. I am new in Rwanda. Now I'm getting to be integrated in my country. The first word I heard, you know, Denise, these are Hutu. These are Tutsi. Be careful. I started to get the poison of division. Hmm? Yeah, these are Twa. They are also Twa in Rwanda. Hutu, Twa, they are three ethnies, so-called ethnies. So they knew each other first because the member of the church, membership, the card, it was written Hutu, or Twa, Tutsi. So everywhere, we know each other.
But at the same time, everyone spoke the same language. Mm-hmm. People intermarried. Mm-hmm. People were neighbors in the same communities. Mm-hmm. People had grown up together. Mm-hmm. But the colonial powers had created these divisions. Mm-hmm. And as Wolfgang said, there were even ways that originally someone in one classification, a Tutsi, a Hutu, for example, could become a Tutsi. Mm-hmm. But then it became not possible to do that, and these identities became so fixed. Mm-hmm. When the genocide began, mm-hmm. tell us how you knew what was happening. What were you aware of on the day of the plane crash and then the few days after that?
It was 7th April, early morning. Normally in Rwanda, people who know Rwanda, before early morning, 6 o'clock, they were always after news, listening to the news. They used to speak about announcement, people who died. It's normal. But at that time, when I woke up, I listened always only classical music, because when they finished to announce people who were who died, they gave classical music. But at that time, it was long classical music, non-stop and classical music. Say, what happened today? Then I went to ask my neighbor. Yeah, my neighbor. I said, what happened today? He said, you do not know what happened? The aeroplane of the president was shot. Now he died with the president of the Burundi and the other people who were together with him. Then he said, now we Tutsi will be killed. But I could not understand how we will be killed. Why? Why will be killed? Then because she was older than me, she said, you know, I know it has been happened always in the years, in the other years. Now they will be killed. It was 7th, and I went at home, and then behind the gate, a young boy who worked in a cement company, he was in the party called CDR, Power Hutu. He was shouting, he's a colleague of my cousins, Manasseh. You read the name of Manasseh in my book. And he said, do you think that you are more important woman than Uwiringiyimana Agatha? Uwiringiyimana Agatha was a primary minister, a Hutu, moderate Hutu, who was against the killing. Then he said, this man, your time has come. Your time has come. What does mean that? You know? But he did not attack me at that, just speaking behind, because the gate was closed.
Prime Minister Agathe was one of the first people killed. And this is very typical in a genocide. The people who are the moderates, the people who may be able to get people to agree not to be violent, to put down their weapons, are those who are taken out first. And Prime Minister Agathe, a moderate Hutu, was brutally killed, as were UN peacekeepers, Belgian UN peacekeepers at that time. Now, you were 9 months pregnant, and if you can speak about that with us, what was that experience for you at that time, being pregnant when the genocide began?
It was a hard time. Even to be myself pregnant at that time, people were saying, "You, Denise, are you crazy? You do not know that there is a war in the country," because I did not plan to be pregnant. When my husband was released from the prison, he used to come evening, night, and early morning. He must again leave. And then, at that time, when we were attacked on 16th April. That was our time to be killed. In my house were 10 people. My young cousins, because my uncle sent to me cousins to stay with me, my brother-in-law, so all were 10 people. In the house, when I heard that we're going to be killed, first I gathered my people. I'm going to say how I gave birth. I gather my people, we say goodbye, we ask forgiveness, but I have the feeling that some of us will be killed, others will survive. But I tell to them, for those who will be killed, we meet in heaven, rendezvous au ciel, spoken French. And then when they attacked us, everyone must flee and take his way. I went to the bathroom. In the bathroom, there, really I struggle with God. Why you never tell me the truth? That's how I will be killed. Shortly, the killers faced me, but they did not kill me. They asked me money. I went to the bathroom. I went to my bedroom to give them money. I met my people in agony down. I gave them money. When I gave money, one said, "Let her, she's not dangerous. Everyone took money, but another said, "No, why not want to kill this Tutsi woman?" He rose the sword to kill me. Another stopped his hand. "No." Then they went to kill others. Then, after, because I had my second son, I went outside. I gave my second son to my houseboy. He was still alive. Then I came back into my bedroom. I crawled under the bed. I laid in the blood of my cousins. The whole afternoon, whole night, during the night, in the blood, under the blood, listening my cousin crying, then it was time to give birth, my water broken. You can imagine the situation. Then later, I went to my neighbor, he was a Hutu, she helped me. When I came to her, she was also afraid. Because if I open for you, the killers will kill me and you. But she was kind to open for me a door. And before I gave birth, again they came to plunder my house, to kill. Now we are in 70th April, early morning. And then she was very afraid. "Please get out." I couldn't. I delivered my baby. She said, "Get out." I couldn't. I was very dizzy. Then I have an idea, maybe I can get out from this room, go in storeroom with my baby. I will let the door half open. If the killers come, no one will have an idea if someone's on behind. Shortly, they came in the house. They did not discover me. They threw grenades. The first did not explode. The second did not explode. This is how I gave birth. That's why I'm here. But they killed others.
It's an unbelievable story, isn't it? To give birth in those conditions and to be able not only to survive it, but to be able to talk about it and to be able to have the courage to sustain then the life of the newborn and to continue caring for the two other children. And many Hutus throughout the country helped to save Tutsis. Many Hutus helped you and your boys, just like Germans who helped to save Jews or Turks who helped to save Armenians. What do you think inspires people to do what is right, to do what is just? What inspired Hutus, some Hutus, to help Tutsis and not to be the murderers?
First, I must say that no many Hutu helped, unfortunately. If there were many Hutu who helped, many would survive. Unfortunately, the majority, I tell the truth, I'm a witness, majority were involved, directly or indirectly. Of course, there were other few Hutus who got the courage. For myself, I saw some angels from God who support me. I did not expect them to help, because people whom I expected to help, they did not help, unfortunately. Because in Rwanda, all Hutus, all religious were involved to kill. I have one good example of a Hutu who helped me. I asked him myself this question. He came from the family of Habyarimana North. His father was a soldier from Habyarimana. His name Witpol. You will find him in the book. After the genocide, ask Witpol, why you did not be involved to kill or to plunder? He was such a really poor man. Why you with his wife Josephine? You will see his story. He said, no, Denise, since I got to know, to be saved and to know Jesus and to come to the cross, me, Witpold, I cannot kill, I cannot do evil. It was his testimony, and really I was touched to hear, because pastors, unfortunately, Christians involved killing directly or indirectly, all religious, Muslim, all. And for me, it was really curious. Then I said, oh, there is a possibility to say no to the evil and say yes to the good, because there were Witpold was a good example. Like others, we have other brave people who were killed. There are Hutu who were killed because they did not accept to be separated from the Tutsi. I think it's decision. We have inside our a capacity to say, to do good, and a capacity to do bad things. So it's our own decision, and the decision of good. If you do good things, you will never regret.
You ask a very difficult question in the book. You ask, could we Tutsis have done this if we were in the majority?
That was my question. What would be happen if Tutsi were on the power? Would we do that? Could kill like how we experienced.
I think that what you just said is so important for all of us, that we have the capacity for good, and we also have the capacity for evil. Mm-hmm. And we get to make that choice every day in so many different ways. Mm-hmm. You have written a very powerful memoir, and I hope everyone here tonight will buy a copy of it. survivors of the genocides in Cambodia and Bosnia and Darfur, the Holocaust and other genocides, have also written memoirs. Mm. What do you hope your book will inspire in the people who read it?
In my book, really, the people will get many things which will empower them. But most, I would wish that people learn how to forgive. You should not wait genocide. Should not wait discrimination. Please forgive, apologize when it is still possible. It's possible. I wish that people really would get through my book healing. So everyone here is dealing with wounds or problems. I hope that people will find encouragement how they will overcome the problems they have in daily life. I forgive the killer, killers who killed my husband publicly. It was not just by words. I made a step. No one from them came to see me, but I make a step. It was a big decision. I make a step, and I forgive publicly. And in Rwanda today, we are really a model for all the world, a country of unity and reconciliation, where we live in neighborhood with the former Hutu and the former Tutsi. Today, no Hutu, no Twa, no Tutsi. We are one, all one, Rwandan, and we are fighting for the good. So it's a process, but we choose to not make revenge, as my country took revenge. This is a grace we got by God.
You said earlier that it's a small country, and everyone knew who was Hutu, who was Tutsi, and who was Twa. Mm-hmm. And today, as you just said, those words are no longer used. Mm-hmm. But everyone still remembers who was Hutu, who was Tutsi, who was Twa. Mm-hmm. How have the people and how has the country tried to reshape that identity?
Oh, Rwanda has a very good politic of unity and reconciliation. There is no, again, division among Hutu and Tutsi. All children have all are equal. They get the right to attend the school without any discrimination. There is no market of Hutu or market of Tutsi. All attend same market, same churches, and we work together. For example, Rwanda has one day per month where we do a so-called Umuganda. Umuganda is very good politic also for reconciliation, where we clean in our neighborhood. We clean. And when we clean, we come together. That means if even I do not want to talk to my neighbor, but when I want in Uganda, I must, when we are cleaning, I must even say, hello, how are you, how are your children? And after that, when we finish to work, we sit together. And we spoke problems which are in neighborhood. If there is problem, it is spoken publicly. It's the way also to bring people together, this Umuganda. And for example, during the commemoration period in Rwanda, we remember people who were killed during genocide. There are Tutsi and some also moderate Hutu who were killed. Everyone come, attend, and helped. Yes.
A genocide is not a tsunami or an earthquake or a hurricane. Genocides are man-made, and therefore they could be prevented. And as Wolfgang said, the world knew what was going on in Rwanda and did nothing. What do you think ordinary people can do when they know that mass atrocities like genocides are happening, like today against the Rohingya Muslims, for example, in Myanmar. What could or should ordinary people do?
Excuse me?
What could people do to prevent genocide?
To prevent genocide, first, to love each other, to respect each other. Normally, some people used to think they are higher than others, but it's a wrong ideology, because all we are equal before God. The God who made us equal. He loves us, he loves everyone. For me, I have seen that, I can testify when I was praying, crying. I have a question, how again I will live in neighborhood with these people who have done wrong things to me, who are no more like human beings, if no more than animals, because you say animals were kind. But when I was praying, seeking solution, and voice told me, please, love. Give them chance, these people, even to feel that they did wrong so that they can repent. Really, I discovered the love of God to all human beings. I was thinking these people should be killed because they have done wrong. But God showed me no. Love them. Show them that I am God. They can even repent. They should feel guilt to repent what you have done. I discovered a love of God. We are equal. Respect each one. Support each one. I know here you are dealing with many refugees who are coming. It's your task to help them. Whatever a politics can be done, but you, individual, please, God said, support your neighbor as yourself. Help. Even what you have, you got, is by grace of God. Share, help. I think respect is more important. Love is important. And to say no. As I listened, if the voice which was telling me, do not be overcome by evil. Overcome evil by doing good. Every day, there is always voices. You know, I heard always voices which were this all too bad. But voice be overcome. Do not be overcome by evil. Do good. And I supported. I helped. I said, no, love, no. This is my image. This is, he was made by me. For the image of God. So it's possible. It's possible to prevent genocide by respect, tolerance. I think if I disagree with you, it will not be a reason to hate me. No.
That was a beautiful answer. Thank you. One of our guests in the audience asks a very interesting question. How do children today learn about the genocide? What are they taught?
My children grew up also really in a difficult situation, of course, because I was a traumatized mother, traumatized. I was traumatized. I did my best to help them to not grow up in hate as I experienced. I helped them to grow up in love. But all my three boys, everyone is dealing also with the trauma in one another way. My 4 years old, 25 years after genocide, before I came here, I had a talk with him about what happened. He told me, Mama, I still have images from the genocide. I don't even want to talk about it. My second son, he grew up in deep trauma. I'm telling the truth. Deep trauma. Trauma, if once he wanted to make even suicide. But he told me, the voice told him, do not do that. Do not do that. And he stopped. You can understand even the question, why my father was killed. Until now, we have never buried our papa, the papa of my children, because no one told us. This is another trauma we have. Many people in Rwanda are seeking their belonging, because their beloved one, because some Hutu are not ready to tell where they put them. We still hope. It's a process. Yes.
We have another very interesting question from a guest. Mm-hmm. What was the role of the United Nations after the genocide?
After. Yeah.
Before,
I can say, for me, let me tell you what first, I was disappointed because they left us during the genocide. And it was also another process to forgive until I came 2009 to United Nations. I did not plan it, but I was able also to forgive because I was in a process of forgiveness. After the genocide, of course, they came back to Rwanda. They sent soldiers to make securities to help. I think now it's that is good.
We started with memories of happy days when you were younger, and we've now talked about the tragedy and forgiveness and healing and love. I want to get back to your life now. She and Wolfgang live in Germany, and you describe in the book what a big decision, of course, to think about moving to a different continent, to move from Africa to Europe. Share with us an amusing or an unusual quick story about making that adjustment from living in Rwanda to living in Germany and to winter.
When I moved from Rwanda to Germany, for me everything was new, of course. Everything was new. I must learn everything, even the language, everything. And in Rwanda, we are spontaneous. In our culture, we do not have appointment. Huh? I can come, I can go to my neighbors, and he's also, oh, welcome, we can share food. But in Germany, oh, must have appointment. Every day, my husband telling me, calendar, we should take our agenda, now we make plan. These things also, which was funny for me, different, of course, yeah.
That's lovely, thank you. You and others have truly been transformed through faith to heal, to forgive, and to reconcile from the trauma of genocide. But you've taken it a step further. You have formed an organization called Ariba Shalom, meaning Source of Peace. Would you and Wolfgang tell us a little bit about Ariba Shalom?
Yes, he will tell about it, but before he says something, just to tell you that when I was still a widow in Rwanda, together with my colleagues, I think you saw some picture of these women whom they cut the head of the children in front of their eyes. I used to visit them. And when I was with them, I was thinking, what can I do to these women? Before, I was thinking, I'm the one who suffered a lot. But when I met the others, I saw there was many, many problems. Women were raped. 250,000 to 500,000 women were raped. 17 HIV positive. And then I was just listening the voice. Show them love. Show them I did not let them alone. Help them to get back the dignity. And I think even we suffered a lot, but there's still a hope that we can even be source of encouragement from ourselves, source of hope, a source of healing, a source of joy, and even people can come to us and learn from us. This is how I started with these widows in the village. Now, today, not only the process of healing trauma, many were ready to forgive, but I have never forced anyone, but through this work, showing them love, that they are varied people, that they are no more cockroaches, they are human beings, they are loved by God. So we share, working together. I went to the field, we work together, we pray together, we sing, we dance, we weep. And then now, it's a process. Now we are a source of encouragement. If you come to visit them, you're not back at the same, because you will get inspiration. Even in Rwanda today, it's Iriba. It's Iriba where you go, unique in unity and reconciliation.
Mm. That's just wonderful. Mm. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you, Ellen, for a wonderfully moderated discussion. Denise, I'll invite you to come to the lectern here, and Wolfgang and Denise will share a little bit more about the work that Ariba Shalom mm-hmm. is doing in Rwanda.
Mm-hmm. Yes, again, we thought it might be good to show you some pictures to make it more vivid and illustrative. So we have, personally, I have been working for Rwanda since 22 years, but now since 4 years in the organization which Denise has founded, some with other friends. And in Rwanda, we have two partners called Shalom Ministries in Kigali and Iriba Shalom. So both times you see the word Shalom, the Hebrew word, plays a big role, which means peace and well-being. The first one of Shalom Ministries is mainly work of reconciliation and many projects. There are, for instance, the Peacemaker Women. You say a few words about
this,
them?
These Peacemaker Women are the women who come from different background. They are Tutsi widow who lost their husband, Tutsi. They are Hutu women whose husband are in the prison. There are Hutu widow who lost Tutsi husband during genocide, and there are Tutsi women whose husband are in the prison. And before, they hated each other. They told me it was like a fire among us. Some of them, Tutsi, went to the prison to see if Hutu would bring food to the husband who are in the prison. And then they took the food, they threw it out. This was the hate. But together, they work together. Today they work together.
They got a prize by the regional government for the work. Mm-hmm. And there's also a new generation of young people, which is a hope for Rwanda today. The second partner is Iriba Shalom, which means, as Denise said, fountain of peace and well-being. And their main focus is the healing process of traumata and many, many income-generating projects. This is a place where the mothers had to bring their baby boys, and exactly at this place is a new place of hope. Today, there's still trauma therapy and Christian trauma counseling has priority.
Example, I'm there make comforting a widow who was forced to kill her own children.
Yeah. Healing and change is also made by income-generating projects. For instance, in agriculture, young people help the older and the weak, or we get donations for cows and goats. We see this elderly woman from Germany with a cow ceremony, and a young man from our town donated many cows. We have bought some knitting machines so they make pullovers because it's not always warm in Rwanda. It's more rain seasons and dry seasons. And sewing projects, this is a special woman Denise will say a few words about.
It's like I'm allowed to state the story. She gave me, she asked me
permission.
Excuse me, I'm missing. This woman, she's HIV positive. She was infected by HIV positive. And when I met her, she had already wrote her testament. She thought she's going to die. And she told me her worries. And I take her hand, I told her, come. Because I stopped to work in cement company to help others because they were in need. There were many problems. I decided, this was another decision. I brought her in a small group where we were helping widows who were affected during the genocide, were raped. And since I took her hand, she got hope. She got hope. When I married with him, she asked him, may I give you a present? I said, which kind of present? Buy a material. And she make a nice wedding of civil marriage. Now, not only that, hope rose. She told me, you know, now I'm ready to go to make a Bible, to go to back to school, to learn a Bible, to do Bible school, because I want not only do external beauty to women, but even inner beauty to people who were suffering like me. This is Teofil.
So you see, many of the dresses of my dear wife are made by this woman. I'm grateful to her. On the right side, you see others are making these handicrafts, which we sell in Germany. Maybe you can also order some hundreds of them.
Not only that this, I helped to write testimony of women who were raped during genocide and who were affected. And a professor of criminal law in Holland make a book, The Man Who Killed Me. And then she asked me, which kind of present can I give you? I said, African clothes. Okay. It was sewed by her.
Yeah, widows work together here. For instance, peanuts, no? Harvesting.
Yes, these are women, we encourage them not to be alone, to work together. They meet, they work together, and after working together, they pray. They spoke about testimonies, they encourage each other. This is, we encourage always to work together in order to break the loneliness.
We give them microcredits for little businesses, for instance, for a stand on the market, or we build or repair their houses sometimes, when also with the guests from our countries. And these international visits are very important, that they feel not to be let alone, like in 94. But I tell always my guests, you see, with my first group visit in many years ago with medical doctors from Germany, first we must listen and see and appreciate what the Rwandans have done long before us, and then we help. This was last year, the visit here is a memorial site where 250,000 people were buried beside. On the right side, you see our group, also in the middle with an elderly Swiss lady. She said, I was in many countries, but the visit to Rwanda was most important, most exciting for me, and I returned to my country as a changed person. Last year, we also celebrated the inauguration of the multifunctional center in the southwest, an oasis of hope. The plot was donated by Denise's mother-in-law.
You can see my mother-in-law. She lost 8 boys. You can imagine how I faced her. I took her, so I told to her, I will stay behind you.
And she was grateful for her survival.
You can see she cannot read or write, but she has always her Bible. And one time, I faced many obstacles. I was ready to stop the work, and she told, I went to tell her, I cannot no more do the work because I have many people who are against what I'm doing. It was the truth. And then she told me, no, my daughter, do not stop. God told me something. What God said? God told me I shall give as a present to Iriba Shalom a plot where widows will continue to get to gather and to get healing. And even this neighbor Hutu who killed us will come there to find love. Really? It was, then I told her I will come back. And I went, now it was the day she gave the plot. We were praising God there.
So there is new life and hope at this very place of death and horror. They find their fellowship, trauma counseling, get training in different areas, and preparations for small projects. And we were very happy that by sponsors of Daimler, the Daimler workers, they were giving money last year for a new IT center, and we also transported wheelchairs and other nice things. For instance, this girl had to sit before in this box, a handicapped girl, and she was happy that we could carry now children's wheelchair to Rwanda. This is a great help by sponsorships. I want to encourage you to join us because they give a sustainable change of life of children, not only of children, but also of mothers who lost all their children and have adopted many other children. We see amazing changes. This is the same girl on the left side, Agnes, before and after, and you see her German parents which care for her, wonderful people who always go to Rwanda and help there. Also for seniors and mothers in Iriba Shalom, for instance, Lotari, she was thrown into a latrine like so many others to die slowly, but she was lucky to escape, one of the few. First she was like crazy and she took a lot of alcohol, but then she found this community of Iriba Shalom and new faith, and here Denise is reading, translating a letter of a German elderly lady which is a sponsor for her, and she is happy and cries of joy. Seniors are happy of friendships with older people, young people from our town. We give them education for children and young people. They discover their own gifts and sometimes also medical assistance for the effects of the genocide. This young woman, as a baby, her arm was cut off and still she has a lot of pain until now, and we are seeking now a very good prosthesis for her. We are in contact with some people, but maybe some of you can contribute too. She's also a world champion in Taekwondo of her class of handicapped people. Here, this is the great miracle of reconciliation. On the right side, beside me, you see the killer of the children of this mother. He was in prison, then he was became free. He was told, like so many others, to ask for forgiveness. Finally, she forgave him. And today, they say, we are one family. She says, he is my son. And he says, she is my mother. You cannot demand that, but it happens 1,000 times. Therefore, my wife said, Rwanda has become a model for the world, for the many areas of conflict. It's always a miracle. And now let me finish with these two pictures. We all can contribute that 25 years after this terrible genocide, Rwandans are not let alone again. That healing, reconciliation, multiply. And the joy there in Rwanda and among us. Normally we show a video here about these women dancing. And we hope that there will grow a lively partnership between Iriba Shalom Rwanda and also America, maybe between Global Minnesota too, by correspondence, sponsorships, support for specific projects, prayers, and hopefully mutual visits. Thank you very much.
To close out our program this evening, we're going to end the program with Denise reading from a passage from her book. But I just want to echo what Ellen said before in thanking Denise for sharing your just amazing story. I mean, for us, the story of your survival is amazing, but the story of the forgiveness for many of us is just unfathomable. And your pointing us towards what we can do in our own lives personally, we ask, how do we respond to something like this? How do we act to prevent this kind of evil in the world? Well, we can start with ourselves, and we can start with the forgiveness that we're not that we're withholding from people. But we can also act in a bigger way in connecting with organizations like yours and with World Without Genocide. So when the question comes, how do we respond to this? What do we do about this? We have the answers right here. So we'll end our program now hearing from Denise.
I have heard that in the United States, people remember exactly what they were doing when planes hit the Twin Towers. In my country too, we remember a plane crash that way. There is this difference. On September 11th, nearly 3,000 people died. In Rwanda, smaller in size and population than Ohio, the number was 3 times that many every day for 100 days. Or think of it this way: if you stacked 15 copies of this book, every word would represent one man, one woman, or child murdered during the genocide against the Tutsi. I'm trying to help people grasp what happened, because no one can picture a million human being killed, not even with who survived. The killing reached Bugarama on April 16th. How gladly I would forget all I saw that day, but as war veterans can confirm, such images are seared into the brain as if by a camera's flash. So, as a witness to the genocide against the Tutsi, I must tell what happened, no matter how painful it is for me to write. I hope my account will help ensure that nothing like this ever happens again anywhere on earth. But I also write because genocide is not the end of the story. Not for me, and not for my beloved country. Thank you.